Hi, this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan. It's great to have you back, Nish.
Yeah, I've been on holiday and I've immediately had a ice cold glass of water poured directly over my head as the first of the revelations coming out of the Mandelson files has appeared. So the Mandelson files are the emails and conversations about Peter Mandelson's appointment as the US ambassador. And there have been some spicy revelations already.
People talk about the holiday blues or the post-holiday blues. Like, what is it when it's this dark? It's not navy. It's the darker shade of something.
It's midnight blue. It's real. Okay. Yeah.
Later, we're joined by the critical theorist Louisa Munch to dig into the government's new social cohesion strategy, which doesn't quite add up.
And of course, we'll get to Iran. But first, we all wanted to know what Keir Starmer knew and when he knew it. Now we can see it all in black and white. A warning was made about Peter Mandelson's ongoing relationship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. It was laid out in a vetting document which the Prime Minister saw before Mandelson became the UK's ambassador to the US.
It's just one of the revelations from the official collection of documents about the process followed when Lord Mandelson got one of the biggest jobs in government. The Prime Minister was essentially forced into releasing the documents by Parliament, and the release was announced in the Commons by the Cabinet Office Minister, Darren Jones.
Today, I can confirm that we are releasing a first tranche of documents which have been laid in the House in advance of this statement and are now published on gov.uk for the public.
So let's get into it. And first up, we have to look at this vetting document. Amazingly, the findings start with a focus on Mandelson's financial and business interests before getting into anything to do with Jeffrey Epstein.
Which, you know, people talk about burying the lead. I think if it was me, I'm just saying I might have started somewhere else. But when it does get there, it is very clear that the two men remained in contact, even after Epstein's conviction for procuring a child for sex. Keir Starmer was also told that Mandelson reportedly stayed at Epstein's home while the financier was in prison in 2009. So let's just make that clear. Starmer knew that they were pals.
Now, look, before we go any further, we should point out the document also includes Mandelson's denial of a professional or business relationship with Epstein, and he has previously denied any wrongdoing. Mandelson was arrested by the police on suspicion of misconduct in public office in February.
The document also mentions a meeting that Epstein had with Tony Blair, which was facilitated by Mandelson. And amazingly, the conclusion for this section of the document is that there was only a general reputational risk. So Darren Jones admitted that the documents showed that the vetting process hadn't really been good enough. He announced measures to improve the process and to remove any payoffs for ministers who were found to have breached the ministerial code of conduct.
So look, just in case anyone needs a quick summary on this, Mandelson was obviously a key figure within New Labour. He was the business secretary from 2008 to 2010. He was appointed as the UK ambassador to the US in 2024 and was sacked in September 2025 when the Epstein files revelations revealed the depth of his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. He resigned from the Labour Party after another tranche of files were released. So obviously, in terms of the current government, the important questions are, what did Starmer know and when did he know it? As we've covered, he was made aware that Mandelson continued to have a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Again, we were all sort of tying ourselves in knots over this. Everybody was aware of this.
Yeah.
As in, people who had access to the internet were aware of this. You know, there are various people who at the time were posting the photograph of Mandelson with Epstein in a kitchen that was just available and in the public domain. So, I mean, it does feel a bit strange that we're having to have this conversation when in reality, anyone with an internet connection was aware that Mandelson had persisted in pursuing a personal friendship with a man who had been found guilty of child sex offences. There was internal government disquiet about this appointment as well. So Jonathan Powell, who's the National Security Advisor, when he was informed of this, he raised his concerns with Starmer's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. He was then told that those concerns were addressed. Now, in the revelations that have come out today, Powell is revealed to have called the decision unusual and weirdly rushed. And a letter from the Prime Minister's principal private secretary to Starmer about the decision to appoint Mandelson said, "Your chief of staff has discussed Peter's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, which we will go through with you." So, I mean, there is this sort of strange situation that we're finding ourselves in where we're being surprised by revelations that we already fucking knew in the first place.
Right. But I do think it is important that we see all of this, because not that we buy the idea of ignorance. I mean, of course we don't. Like you've said, Anish, everybody knew about it. I mean, I saw an interview with Ian Hislop recently, and he, you know, they were publishing stuff about it from 2009. So that's, you know, well over a decade of this stuff circulating. And it is very serious, right? You would expect it only needed one article for you to really think about it. But, you know, this was quite known. But the point is that there were several instances forced Starmer to exercise some caution, and he did it. Not just the vetting document, you know, there was people around him telling him, hang on a minute, this is strange. And so it does speak to a lack of judgment, doesn't it? And that's putting it kindly.
It is very serious for Keir Starmer because of the public offering he has been making to the country over the course of the last general election campaign, and then once he's taken up his job as Prime Minister. Because part of his public offering is that he is the former prosecutions guy. He is the lawyer. He is the person who follows every rule to a T. And he is also the person who is a distinct break with the last kind of half decade of rolling scandals and incompetence from the Conservative government. And so I think this matters. I mean, this matters hugely anyway, because it reveals a lot about the ways that decisions are made at the very heart of our government. But I think it matters more for Keir Starmer than maybe a different prime minister. I don't know how you feel about that, Coco.
I always find it hard to think about the brand of Keir Starmer, but he does have a brand. And certainly one of it was that he was the lawyer, right? He's going to do things right. I think, you know, what you were saying about what this reveals, it certainly reveals that how government is working. It reveals power, the kind of crude strength of power. And I think that feeling is really destroying our faith in democracy, our faith in institutions, our faith in each other. It's so corrosive, and you would expect Starmer to understand that.
And just to restate, Peter Mandelson has always denied any wrongdoing. He's apologised to Epstein's victims and has described his relationship with the convicted sex offender as a most terrible mistake. It's also worth noting, in terms of Mandelson's own actual comments on this issue, as part of the revelations we found out today, there has been an email discussing what his compensation was going to be. So he's actually received £75,000 in compensation for being removed as the US ambassador, the ambassador to the US, I should say. Extraordinarily, we found out today that he asked for £547,000, which is essentially what he would have earned if he'd seen out the rest of his four-year contract. The £75,000 he has received is a pretty nauseatingly high figure, but made worse when you realise that £34,000 was a discretionary payment on top of the £40,000 that he was legally entitled to. And that does sting somewhat.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, actually, I happened to catch a glimpse of Darren Jones trying to defend this in Commons. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but he essentially said, look, Mandelson was a civil servant, so he was entitled to something. And also he kind of said he would sue us. And this was the settlement. So this was actually good given what he could have done. You know, all this whole story of power and who has it and who doesn't have it. And actually, I do wonder if, even though this whole episode is nowhere near drawing to a close anyway, I do fear that it's not going to give us a sense of reconciliation or healing. I think actually it's the crater is only going to get wider.
We'll see more stuff coming out as more and more documents, information are released. I think in the short term, this furthers the reputational damage that's already been done to Keir Starmer. I think this poses a really serious question about his judgment. I think the only thing at the moment that's keeping him in a job is the lack of willingness for anyone within the Labour Party to step up to try and replace him. I think there's just an absence of candidates. I think at this point now, he is essentially on borrowed time.
So as we said, this national conversation that we're having about all of this is ongoing. And even just in terms of this this document drop. There's more to come. There's thought to be tens of thousands in all. It will include WhatsApp messages between Mandelson and Labour politicians. There'll be documents which the police have asked the government to withhold until their investigation is complete. And this whole process is going to take some time. So look, we will be keeping an eye on it and following it. And as a reminder, the many victims of Jeffrey Epstein are still waiting for justice. This process is a small part of that, but in the US, there's a real lack of action by investigators.
After the break, we are in the studio with the critical theorist and big brain on social media, Louisa Munch, to understand why the government thinks social cohesion can be built on fostering suspicion between immigrants and white people. As per usual, we got more of that coming up after the break. Before we throw to the break, I just wanted to quickly flag something that I forgot to plug. If you live in London or are able to get to London on Wednesday, the 18th of March, that is next Wednesday as we record, I am screening my stand-up special, Nish Don't Kill My Vibe, on the cinema screen at the Ritzy in Brixton, which I am very, very excited about. And so there'll be a full screening of the thing. It's the first time anybody's seen it, apart from me and my friends Alan Stew, who direct and edit it. And let me tell you, it is a particular form of torture to have to watch yourself on a screen over and over again for hours at a time. It is a real... People should use it as an information extraction scheme by various secret services. It's bad stuff. But I'm very proud of the special, and you can watch it at the cinema on the 18th of March. And afterwards, there will be a Q&A conducted by off-menu's own James Jimmy Acaster. He will be interrogating me in a sort of Frost Nixon for elder millennial comedy fans.
Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Aura Frames.
Aura Frames are the solution to all of those photos that just get jammed up in your phone, never allowed to see the light of day.
Tell you what, Sophie, if you do the show enough, I'm going to get you an Aura Frame.
Are you?
Yeah, I mean, I have one. I gave one to my mum. I'm always talking about in these ads about how great they are as a gift. And like, genuinely, they're great. I can just, I can upload photos before I give it to you. I can get it in a gift box because I'm lazy, because I'm not good at wrapping. You get to remember me for all time. It'll just be very close-ups on face and niches.
That sounds like a very efficient threat. I can get you headshots, you know, easily, as easy as clicking. Yeah. I've got so many photos that I want to do something with, but I never do. There's a sort of like paralysis because I'm just like, well, what am I? I hate like sending it to drives or like putting it in a, you know, WhatsApp, other messaging systems are available. I just want to be able to love and hold my photos to me.
Well, I mean, what I'm gathering from this is please, Coco, get this gift and send it to me pre-uploaded with your face. So just as a quick reminder for anyone who has not yet got an Aura Frame, it's free unlimited storage. You can preload the photos before it ships. You get the gift box and it's been named number one by Wirecutter. So, you know, rave reviews all round. And you can save on this perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com. Our listeners get $35 off. So that's PSTUK. That's the code you need. You want to use it on the best-selling Carver matte frame. That's Aura Frames, AURAframes.com, promo code PSTUK. Don't forget to support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
So the government's new social cohesion strategy is promising a lot, challenging hate, building community spirit, even improving high streets. But how ministers plan to get there is maybe a bit less clear. We'll let them get away with the absolutely stupid name, protecting what matters. But in the report, there are also some pretty contradictory points being made.
Right. So, for example, the report says that integration is a two-way street, but then it only really lists ways that immigrants can make more of an effort. Or the quote from the head of MI5 saying that labels like Islamists and extreme right wing don't properly reflect the array of beliefs and ideologies out there. But then the report continues to use those terms.
There's definitely some positive stuff in there. Money for left behind communities, investment in youth and sport facilities, and actual steps to help prevent the spread of hate and discrimination. But does it do enough? Here's the Community Secretary Steve Reid announcing the government's plans to the Commons.
Britain has faced global crises at many moments in our history. And we got through them by staying strong and united. Today, we navigate new threats to our communities and families, and we must stand together once again against those who seek to divide and weaken us.
So there's a lot to work through and try to understand. So it's great to be joined by the critical theorist, Louisa Munch. She's all about dissecting the systems we live in and how they are affecting our lives, which she does on Instagram, urging her many, many thousands of followers to engage with the news with the skills usually kept to university departments. Louisa, welcome to PodSave the UK.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
What a title. Critical theorist.
I know.
That's a hell of a job title.
I don't know if that's what my university would call me, a teacher, but it sounds a bit more academic.
Your university is my old university. You teach
really?
At Warwick. Yeah, that's where I went. And a part of me was like, I wonder if we could have some, you know, ice-breaking Warwick chat. And then I remember that all my references are so old and it will out me. So... We're just going to move on and say I'm so glad you're here to teach the young Cocos of the future how to think critically. Anyway, let's start with some of the inconsistencies in this report. So, I mean, one of the things that stood out to me and I just find incredibly frustrating all the time is about how integration is a one-way street. It's always about how immigrants should act rather than how whole communities should treat each other with respect. Why do you think it's so hard for politicians to get this seemingly simple thing, right?
Yeah, well, it seems that they're treating these communities through suspicion and surveillance. And it sounds more like a terrorism framework, anti-terrorism framework, than it does like about community cohesion and things. And there are like a few good things. I had a look and increasing like the spending on community centres and sports facilities and things like that. But generally, it's about like calling out people that you're suspicious of. And that is not going to build bridges. That's just going to make people feel even more hostile towards each other. And like you said, it's always a one-way street. It's these people need to adhere to British values, but what even are British values? Like, it doesn't really lay that out either. So I think if you're going to have a community cohesion, and a lot of European countries do this quite well, like they do have community centres, they do have like English language or whatever the language is, like centres and programmes and things like that. But it's about a community coming together, not about people being suspicious of other people or, you know, like reporting on suspicious behaviour and things like that. So that's like the most worrying thing about it, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't feel like, you know, when you start a new job and they talk about onboarding, that seems to be the mm-hmm. de jure title now.
Well, like, they're onboarding us for the United Kingdom.
Yeah, but you know, like if you're talking about onboarding and it's all like, you know, here's the toilets, this is how we do things. It's not like, by the way, don't commit crime. I feel like they poison the well when they introduce counter-terrorism stuff into a strategy around social cohesion. Like implied in that is the mistrust, right? So then you can't even begin to build communities if there's this distrust.
Listen, in terms of the specifics of the report, English language proficiency is going to be a requirement for new arrivals. It's going to be a review of English lesson provision to identify best practices and explore new methods like digital delivery. The conclusions of that will be due in autumn 2026. There's been a 60% cut in funding between 2008 and 2018 for exactly these services, which led to a 40% reduction in participation by migrants. You know, it feels like every week on the show, we're looking for the black box recorder in the plane crash of the British government's between the years 2010 and 2024. You know, there's so much of it that kind of comes back to funding cuts and all this kind of stuff. But also, a lot of this stuff is obviously policy-based and can be very dry. It's also, for a lot of us, quite sort of personal. My grandmother very sadly passed away earlier this year, and she moved to this country in 1973, and there were no sort of requirements on language proficiency. She sort of integrated because she worked in a light bulb factory. And like, yes, that integration was at points complicated. Her name was Padma, P-A-D-M-A, and she did receive a birthday card addressed to Batman from one of her co-workers at the light bulb factory.
What the fuck? Because she fights crime?
Yeah, I have no idea.
She's a hero.
They just heard the name Padma and were just like, obviously this woman's name is Batman Kuti. Like, but as clumsy as that is, that is what integration looks like. And it's complicated and difficult and requires compromise from both sides. But that is quite a complicated and diffuse thing. Louisa, how do you translate that into policy, you know, that sort of, you know, fumbling and at points complicated and at times ham-fisted approach that everyone has to take when you integrate into a community?
Well, I think this policy is not very critical in the sense that it doesn't get to the crux or the root of the issues that we see in communities at the minute. And it doesn't seem to understand or tackle the problem of how gutted the like communities have been. And like my dad, he's from Denmark, hence the name. And he was the same. He came to this country in the 1980s, I think. And he found communities in football clubs, in places that now have been so financialized that you have to, well, pay to get in, or there's just, there aren't those spaces available at all. My mum worked for Connections, which was obviously like a youth support like program that now no longer has funding. She lost her job in the end. But something like this, like these policies, are not going to have the impact that we really need in terms of this huge cultural shift that needs to happen if we're going to feel, everybody's going to feel safe in this country. And when the language is all about safety and not about stability and inclusion, it's all about exclusion.
The speak English thing, I mean, because that's like the racist insult that is always thrown at like people who are from different countries. Well, they don't even speak English. And it's so weird. I don't know if you ever had this experience, but when I was growing up, my mum came to this country in the 70s. She speaks fluent English. We all speak English as our first language at home. My mum even now dreams in English. She speaks English. But when I was a teenager, I would sometimes do phone calls for my mum to bureaucrats, wherever it might be, the council, whoever it might be, because she was like, if they hear my accent, they're going to tell me I'm stupid. Yeah. If they hear my accent, they're going to treat me badly. Whereas if it was always quite strange, I'd phone them. I'd be like, hello, all right, it's me. I'm an adult woman.
She was trying a northern accent.
And so, you know, like, I'm sort of conflicted because on the one hand, I think we can all agree that, of course, speaking the shared language of the nation you're in is really important and great and wonderful. On the other hand, there's been all this cuts to English language funding. It's enormously oversubscribed. So on the one hand, it's like, well, we're going to hector people for not learning the language, but going to make it really hard to not learn the language. And I know that Labour's now saying they are going to look into rolling it out with their tech services or whatever, which is obviously welcome. But to what extent is fundamentally this policy actually just appealing to those people who want to say they don't speak English? Do you know what I mean? Like, is it appeasement or is it a real policy? What do you think, Louisa?
Well, yeah, like you said, it is important that people can speak the language. But if you look at, like, I always think about Benidorm. I don't know if either of you have been to Benidorm.
Not yet, but I will go.
It's one of the least integrated places I've ever been in my entire life. It actually, I will say, Louisa, it did sort of have a radicalizing effect on me. After I came back from Benidorm, I genuinely was like, I never, ever want to hear they come over here and they don't even learn the language from an English person. After I went to bed, it blew my goddamn mind. It's basically England in Spain. Like, it's a weird, like, white people Wakanda in the middle of Spain. Like, it's a really surprising...
White people Wakanda.
I just got back from a holiday in Mexico City, which was amazing, unbelievable, one of the best places I've been. But people kept saying, oh, the part of the culture is changing because more Americans are coming here on digital nomad visas. And there's this idea that people are moving to places like Lisbon and Mexico City because they can work from anywhere and they get called digital nomads. And all I could think was, man, people will avoid anything to as long as they don't have to call white people immigrants. Like, you're not a digital nomad, you're a computer immigrant. That's all you are. You're a computer immigrant. That's all it is.
This is the thing, like, we can't just say we have these policies in place without changing the language in the media that we refer to, immigrants or migrants. And I don't even like the word immigrant, to be fair, this kind of the prefix I think is unnecessary. They're migrants, people move around. And I don't see why we have such this like hostility in the language that we use around. And the thing is with the history of migration, like, look at the British Empire. It's just so ironic that we can sit here and talk about, like, why other people who generally know English, they've come from places where England or Britain have gone and said, you know, you need to learn English because this is the language of education, this is the language of prosperity, but you're not allowed to come to the country and work. You're not allowed to come to the actual country that, you know, we have come from.
In terms of the what is definitely in the report, there's this extra £750 million for youth and sports facilities to encourage meeting, mixing and stronger bonds. We talk a lot on this show about the kind of decline of town centres and the decline of city centres and the decline of communal spaces where people can interact with each other. Is that something we should welcome? And is the amount sufficient to cover for the sort of decade-long war on youth centres and sports facilities that the austerity era government waged?
Well, no, it's not enough. Like, we, and also it shouldn't be part of the like immigration social cohesion strategy. It should be a strategy to help the community of Britain. Like, this is at the root of most of the problems that we have in society now, is the fact that we no longer have a community. We no longer have spaces where people can interact. You know, I see the university as like a public space as well, and that's been completely financialized and we're facing cuts all of the time.
I'm still thinking about computer immigrant. I'm sorry, I can't get over it. You know, I saw a piece recently that said lots of San Fran tech workers were moving to London. You know, a lot of them are kind of, have like liberal politics and they don't like Donald Trump and they can move wherever they want. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Moving countries because the government does things you don't like. I know some other migrants who do that when they have regimes and stuff. But anyway, moving on, I do want to talk to you about another one of the controversies. So, you know, this policy, it's meant to be targeted action to deal with Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and a more rounded look at racism, you know, which, of course, all sounds welcome. But there's been a lot of focus on the anti-Muslim hate czar. So this is due to be appointed. And there will also be a definition of anti-Muslim hate that kind of comes with it that people will work towards. The idea of a definition has proved to be very controversial. There's some people that are arguing that fundamentally it will be tantamount to a blasphemy law, i.e. you can't make fair criticism of a religion or how it's organised or whatever it might be. It is difficult, though, because a lot of the people sharing that opinion, you know, I'm not sure they're doing it in good faith. But do you think this idea of a definition is important, or is it actually the last thing we need to be thinking about?
Well, no, not really. I don't think we need to have spaces where people can talk about what those definitions mean and what it means to be a Muslim or what it means to be a Christian or what British values mean, because otherwise it does just end up as terms in policies and it's just not helpful to anybody. I think even the language around extremism, like, what does that mean? What is extremism? I remember I did a course on terrorism in Liverpool. It was so interesting to understand this word that shuts down everything. You know, when somebody mentions it was terrorism or it was terror, then the conversation stops. It's just abhorrent. It's just those are bad people. But really understanding what that means and extremism, things like this, that we are always framed in like this horrifying sense, really unpacking that and understanding where that comes from and how it's kind of changed or evolved. I think that's where it really needs to start. I don't think just having these sort of these words in policies are going to really change that.
I see what you're trying to say, that anytime anyone is accused of terrorism, that's the end of the conversation. They are just a terrorist and we have no conversation about how they've been radicalized or what the kind of circumstances. I mean, it's a really interesting, that feels like something we should be talking about. We should be having a full and open discussion about those things.
Yeah, and I think people are afraid so much as well to get things wrong these days. Like, people are so afraid to say the wrong thing. Even I am. You know, I go on a podcast and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get cancelled.
You should meet Nish Kumar.
Yeah, this my whole life is just offending different communities.
Yeah.
Friends, on relatives.
On a week-by-week basis. Communities, co-workers, other comedians.
Well, like, I just think that's so unhelpful, you know? We don't all need to be right at the same time. Like, we need to understand there is no right answer a lot of the times. And it's just about listening and having productive conversations that challenge different notions that are often just taken for granted and stuff like that. So I think we do need spaces where people can come together and do that, whether it is in communities or, and what the media do is like stoke this fear of asking questions, of thinking that certain questions are off limits, or that you can't say certain things, or that we've got like, be afraid of people who are woke because we'll you know, jump down your throat. And okay, yeah, fine. Like, it is a problem on the left. Like, people do, you know, can go at people quite critically about things. But it's just about having compassion. It's just about being compassionate and understanding that, like, everybody is just like you. Everybody just wants to have a nice, happy family, be able to afford to go to the shops. Everybody wants the same thing in life. There are no inherently, like, evil people out there. And asking questions isn't a bad thing.
So, Louisa, I'm so glad we got to speak to you today, not least because I follow you on the internet. I've been listening to you, a lot of your work about the role of universities. So I'm very interested to hear what you are thinking about the part of this strategy that is on universities. So apparently there's new legal oversight to make sure that universities do more to prevent students from being radicalized and drawn into terrorism. This includes the creation of a whistleblowing body. My first question for you is this a problem? Is this an import from America? Because I know there was a lot of talk about campus activism being regarded by some as being, you know, radicalism and being a problem. Mm. And there was a lot of conversations about free speech in universities. Is this an import, or is this a genuine thing that you've seen in higher education?
I genuinely wonder if anybody who wrote this policy has spoken to anyone from universities. Like, ask us what we think the issues are, because the issues are not extremism on campus. The issues are that nobody has any money, that we can't afford to put teachers in classrooms. Like, these are the least of our problems. And we, all we're trying to do is give these students the ability to question and challenge what they see in the media and feel empowered and have some political agency when they go out there and, you know, have to cope with bloody cost of living crisis, things like that. And I just find this kind of, you know, the surveillance of it all, of, okay, so you're now pitting educators against the students. Universities are the one place where that doesn't happen. We sit down with the students. Nobody's stood up, you know, and it's, everybody's on a level basis. And I just find this really strange as well. The whole point of university is having and forming your own critical opinions on things. And that's the key thing. They're critical. There's nobody's walking around with like an ideology they feel so strong about that they can't unpack or be critical around or have self-awareness of or understand on a broader political sense, because you're going to fail university if you do that. Like, the whole point is challenging ideologies. So I'd be really surprised if this is happening on campuses. And again, it's about what kind of extremism. Extremism isn't necessarily regarded in terms of like the far right extremism that we're seeing now. Or, you know, we've just had adolescents come out like last year, a year before.
The sort of adolescence factor is about radicalization of young men, regardless of their race or religion. That's a time bomb that was laid about 10 years ago that's sort of exploding around us right now.
Yeah, and like, radicalization is, you can only do it if you ensure that people can't think critically around things, because you're not going to get radicalized about something if you are thinking critically and questioning and challenging these ideologies. I find the word radicalization a kind of unhelpful anyway, because does it just mean you have a radical opinion on anything? I was on a show called Radical just because I was talking about having free university, you know.
Let's just round this off by talking about the funding crisis at university, because Louise, you've already said that you feel that there wasn't enough consultation with people actually working at universities. And if there had been, it would have been, we need more money, because the crisis is very, very real. 49% of universities are closing courses to reduce costs, and that's a number that's nearly doubled in the space of a year. 45% have cut optional modules, 18% have closed entire departments, and 88% have said that they may need to consider further course closures. Support staff at several universities are taking strike action over pay or plans for that cost cutting. I mean, what is the solution for the university funding crisis? In lieu of the government having this conversation and instead talking about terrorism or whatever the fuck they're talking about in this report, what is the actual practical solution for the university funding crisis?
Well, I just want to say as well, expecting us to now also watch out to see if any of the students are becoming extremist is ridiculous. We are trying to look after our students. Like, they are struggling as much as we are with their mental health, with, you know, the prospect of not having a job afterwards. Like, everybody is struggling. I'd be very surprised if, you know, anybody has any time to then be sifting through any sort of dialogue in case it has like a single nugget of extremism. You know, I'm being radicalized by the university because of how tough everything is for everybody in a way that, I mean, the solution here is it needs to be state funded. It's a public good. People should have the right to higher education. Whatever they choose to do, people should have the right to go and do that. And it shouldn't be seen as this personal investment towards getting a job. Like, it is about agency. It's about being able to participate politically and feeling confident in challenging views and challenging norms. And the solution to me is look at Europe. Look at how they structure universities. They invest in their young people. They're seen as the drivers of the future. They're going to make university free because they want an educated population. I don't understand why we don't have that view in this country.
Louisa, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK. You can find Louisa on TikTok and Instagram at Louisa Munch Theory.
Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Babbel.
So Babbel is a language learning app, and I have been thinking that I would like to learn a language.
Oh.
Yeah. My okay. problem is that I'm, you know, rubbish.
Too, you know, too adorable and perfect.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. Well, actually,
glad
you know,
see.
I just genuinely like, I find it hard to stick with something when I don't feel like I'm making progress. And anyway, the reason I'm mentioning that is because that's the whole thing about Babbel. They use actual real conversations with experts. They try and tell you language you're going to use so you can try it out pretty much immediately. And they're also quite confident that you just 10 minutes a day is enough to start seeing real results. So if you're someone like me who gets easily bored, it may well be the platform for you.
Learning a language with Babbel is all about small steps, big wins, and progress you can actually track and feel, which is so important rather than just staring down the list of verbs and declensions and vocabulary.
Listen, I need validation regularly. So yeah, Babbel lets you practice real-life conversation step by step without the stress. You can build the confidence to speak up when it matters, from ordering a coffee to chatting with friends abroad.
And Babbel is more than just lessons. They also offer a large collection of podcasts where Babbel experts reveal language secrets and offer an inside look at local cultures.
It's all to kind of bring you closer, not only to the language, but the way of life that can be unlocked for you by learning a language. So it keeps you motivated, makes it easy, and it works. It's fast. Babbel has over 25 million subscriptions sold Whoa. Worldwide and has 14 languages to choose from.
Here is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/PSUK. Get 60% off at babbel.com/PSUK, spelled, of course, BABBEL.com/PSUK. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So look, despite all the government's attempts at social cohesion, it's no secret that it's getting harder and harder for migrants to settle in the UK. So just this week, Migration Minister Mike Tapp showed how hard it can be.
OK, so what is the height of the London Eye?
I haven't...
What is the height of the London Eye, Minister?
I don't know the height of the London Eye.
So you would fail the test?
I'm confident that I would be able to pass the test, absolutely. I'm a proud Brit, I've served the country, I've been to war for the country.
So that was Tapp failing one of the questions on the UK citizenship test, which I think it's fair to say we would fail. It was what was the height of the London Eye? Very
Big.
High. Makes
Big.
Me get scared. I get scared that height.
That's not the only part of the system, though, that's getting tougher. Today, hundreds of people from all over the country are meeting their MPs to share their concerns about the government's planned changes to settlement in the UK. That is the right to live in the UK permanently without any immigration restrictions, also known as indefinite leave to remain or ILR.
So in short, from April this year, most people will have to wait 10 years instead of 5 years to be considered for settlement. And settlement will no longer be granted automatically after this fixed period. Instead, migrants will need to earn it by demonstrating sustained good conduct, contribution and integration.
Can I just say, I think this is one of the most stupid policies we've ever covered on this podcast in the last 3-4 years. I think it is beyond boneheaded. I don't understand how you help social cohesion by making people's position in the country even more precarious. And these are people that, you know, they've lived here for 5 years. A lot of these are my friends. These are people who, you know, without wishing to be crass in the case of some of my friends, contribute quite spectacularly in their taxes to this country's public finances. And I have no ability to comprehend why this is the thing that this government is going after. I have no idea what Shabana Mahmood is smoking. Like, I have no clue what could possibly be going through their head with this. It's a huge change that's going to impact not just new immigrants, but also migrants currently living in the United Kingdom. And although there was public consultation, it was brief and extremely limited. The organisers sent us this clip from Westminster today.
Hi everyone, I just came out of Praxis's mass lobby against the government's earned settlement proposals. We were joined by disability rights activists, migrants rights activists, we were joined by the Royal College of Nursing. This is people power in action. We've been here calling for the government to scrap these settlement proposals and at the very least make sure that they're not applied to migrants who are already living in the UK. It was really amazing to see hundreds of people, a lot of people with lived experience, talking to their MPs and telling them exactly how these proposals will affect them. We've had a huge turnout of MPs from loads of different political parties, and this just shows that there is a real opportunity here, so we've got to keep pushing. This is just the beginning. We have a lot more work to do to convince the government that they need to end these settlement proposals. So watch this space. We'll be doing a lot more. Very exciting.
So if you'd like to sign the open letter to the Home Secretary to stop these, frankly, disastrous earned settlement plans, we will put a link in the show notes.
I have no way of conceptualising why they're going after indefinite leave to remain. If you're, even if you follow this logic that, you know, immigrants have to pay their way and integrate, these are people who are paying their way. These are people who are integrated into British society. All I can think is, you know, a phrase that was used on this show and has been used a couple of times that haunts me every single time I think about it is this idea that policy has to pass a Daily Mail test.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Something we've heard from people that work within government, it's something that we've talked about on the show, that policy has to pass a Daily Mail test, that when it's discussed within the walls of government, this phrase Daily Mail test is used. This is the only logic I can think of for why this policy has been generated, that it's something to appease the Daily Mail's editorial board because it is attacking immigrants in any way. There is absolutely no justification for this whatsoever.
The Daily Mail test is also ringing around in my head, especially this idea of sustained good conduct. Who defines what that is? What would the Daily Mail define that as? You know, like the idea of being a bit creative or I don't know. It just gives me the heebie-jeebies. Now, the conflict in the Middle East has only grown over the last 7 days. Listeners and viewers will remember our great analysis about the Strait of Hormuz last week. But 3 commercial ships there have been hit and damaged.
US and Israeli bombs have continued to rain down on Iran, and Iran's drones have struck targets across the Gulf. Over the weekend, strikes on Iranian oil infrastructure caused what can only be described as apocalyptic scenes as massive flames lit up the skyline in Tehran.
But Sunday morning, residents of the city woke to find it still dark, the smoke from the fires blotting out the sun. And soon, black rain began to fall over Tehran, as one CNN reporter documented.
The rain that's coming down seems to be saturated or filled with oil. You can see it's completely black. Everything on the ground is black as well. And if you look over here at this wall, you can see that the rainwater coming down here is also black. This comes after a night of really heavy bombardment here in the Iranian capital that also saw thick plumes of smoke over the city.
In the aftermath of the attacks, Iran's environmental agency and the Iranian Red Crescent Society warned Tehran's residents to stay home because of the toxic chemicals spread by the attacks, which could damage skin and lungs. Many residents are reported to have woken up with pain in their throat and their eyes burning. Experts in the field are also already warning about the long-term environmental repercussions of this bombing.
the rain was black. It was raining oil. I mean, as of Monday, 1,255 people in Iran, mostly civilians, had been reported killed. That's according to the Iranian Health Ministry. This is on top of the hundreds of casualties across the region, including in Lebanon, the Gulf states, and Israel.
Last week, there were also reports of an airstrike on a girls' school in Iran, which killed at least 170 people. Whilst Trump initially denied US involvement, new footage shows that a military base next to the school was likely hit by a Tomahawk missile. Now, this is a weapon used by the US, and Israel and Iran do not have access to it.
So in the UK, Keir Starmer has come under criticism from all sides, really, for his response to the conflict. So previously, he agreed to let the US use British bases for defensive action against Iran, and RAF jets have been shooting down missiles and drones fired towards allies in the region.
So he's obviously been attacked, I guess you would say, from the progressive wing or the left wing of British politics. On the other hand, conservatives have said that the RAF should be directly attacking Iranian missile launch sites. Zach Polansky has criticised Starmer for dragging us into another illegal war and for letting US bombers land in the UK. Starmer's position is complicated here because technically the United Kingdom is not involved in, I guess, active military engagement in the region, but it is still shooting down drones, and we are still allowing the American army use of our military bases. So it's a very, very complicated situation. And some of that complexity is not just affecting the Labour Party and the Labour government, it's affecting reform. Initially, the party seemed to support the action, with Nigel Farage saying that the UK should do all we can to help the US and Israeli bombing. Robert Jenrick, Reform's finance spokesman, has struck a more cautious tone, warned of Britain becoming involved in drawn-out wars in faraway places. Perhaps the least surprising intervention on this has come from former Prime Minister Tony Blair, who has criticised Starmer's approach, reportedly saying at an event, "We should have backed America from the very beginning." Again, with respect, Tony Blair, please shut the fuck up. Also, how have you learned nothing? Like, my main takeaway from all of this is I have been struck in the head and have woken up in 2003. That's the only logical conclusion I can come to, having read some of the arguments, because I cannot believe that twice in the last 20 years, we are having the exact same conversation about a war in the Middle East. I can't believe that we would be going through this again. I can't believe that we'd be in a situation where people would once again be recycling the argument of, oh, well, look, at the end of the day, if you don't support this military action, you are in support of X regime. Right? Mm. It's the same argument that was made with Saddam Hussein. It's the same argument that's being made with the Iranian regime right now. I can't believe we're back here again. So I refuse to. I can only come to the conclusion that it is 2003 again. I have misread an N for a Q. We're supporting an illegal war that America is waging in the Middle East. There's a new Gorillaz album and there's new Scrubs episodes. The only logical conclusion I can come to is that I have been struck in the head and woken up in the early 2000s.
I think it's worse, though, honestly. I mean, I too look forward to a new Gorillaz album, but, you know, at least...
It's out. It's good. Okay. It's out already. Okay. It's very good.
But, I mean, at least they attempted to make
that's right,
something
yes.
up.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, oh, we've got some evidence. We have evidence of the thing. Like, they're not even trying now.
Can't believe that we're looking back at nostalgia. Remember when they at least bothered to lie to us? Yeah. Truly a halcyon era for warmongering.
Oh, God. So, Nish, Sadiq has come out swinging again at all the London naysayers. So his bio on Instagram now reads, "London maxing since 2016. So are you familiar with the maxing trend?
Coco, I'm a 40-year-old man. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I hope you're ready for some how do you do fellow kids explanation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why I've introduced my age there. I was never really aware of what was going on. Even when I was 16.
Yeah.
In 2001 and 2, I was trying to talk to people about Jimi Hendrix and Bob Dylan. So, like, it's like, I don't know why I'm pretending I've now lost relevance.
Some people are born old, aren't they? Anyway, no, that was mean. So the suffix de jour of the internet is maxing. You'll see to all sorts of different words. And the most famously, it's applied to looks maxing, which has come out of incel culture, which is this idea of essentially optimizing your appearance to get women because women are all clearly
the
same.
Isn't that something to do with, like, you break your jaw and stuff so that you...
They're like extreme end, yeah. But there's like a point system attached to it. Anyway, we don't need to get into that. But, you know, that was the the main way you saw maxing applied. And now it's taken on its own life. So you've got monk maxing, which is like when you prioritize like stillness and living a more stoic life, you're monk maxing.
Yeah.
There's all sorts
I was monk maxing in my mid-20s, but that's to do with the amount of sex that was happening. I was really monk maxing.
Well, anyway.
I was 25 years old.
There was China maxing. I actually wrote a story on it. That's why I know about this. But yeah, China maxing is where people enjoy traditions that are Chinese. And now we have London maxing, which is essentially people being quite bullish about London online. You know, London is constantly pilloried. Obviously, we have a Muslim mayor, so it's been a real target of hatred, right-wing hatred, far-right hatred. JD Vance obviously really hates London, particularly so does Donald Trump, it would seem. And so the Londoners are saying, no, we're not having it. We are going to push back. We are London maxing. So it's just people online being like, oh, look at our great pubs. Look at the culture. Look at the fact that so many people are moving here. You know, people are leaving America, but they're coming here.
I've been talking about this on stage, especially when I gig outside of the UK, because I sort of didn't really realise until like, my family from outside the UK started saying, is London safe?
Yes, I've had that as well.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because by all of our metrics, crime is going down in London. I believe with the exception of phone theft. But even phone theft, that's just criminals trying to get us to live in the now. That's just them trying to get us to be in the moment and look up from our goddamn screens. Yeah, it's mindfulness.
Right, okay, yeah.
but by all metrics, you know, violent crime, everything is falling and has been for the last 10 years. London is safer than it's ever been. But perversely, I'm coming out against London maxing.
Okay,
right?
Why is that?
Because I think, you know, our tourism revenues are really good. We're getting people coming into London all the time. I think that the reputation of London as a shithole is keeping out cunts. And I think that's a really good thing.
So you want to see London minimising?
I just think like at the moment our tourism revenues are good. We're getting good people coming to London. This reputation that London has is keeping out some of the worst people in the world, and I think that's a good thing. If JD Vance doesn't want to come to London, that is something we should be encouraging. We should be encouraging JD Vance not to come to London.
I'm open to this as a theory. I think we need to get some cool words in place for it. Let's think on it. But for now, let's have some PSUK maxing. Is that good?
What does that involve?
It's like
just being anxious and South Asian. Is that what PSUK maxing is? Being lightly hungover a lot of the time and having really, really voluminous hair.
Yeah, big hair. Have a doser. Feel scared. Welcome to PSUK maxing.
Now, before we go, you might think that the Chancellor responsible for Liz Truss's disastrous mini-budget, which tanked the economy, might not be the best person to trust when it comes to financial investments. But that isn't stopping Nigel Farage. On Monday, he announced that he had invested £215,000 in Kwasi Kwarteng's Bitcoin Reserves Company.
So Farage has been a long-time supporter of crypto and said that the UK can and should become a major global hub for the crypto industry. It comes as reform has been strengthening its ties with the sector, which definitely has nothing to do with the £12 million donation to the party by crypto billionaire Christopher Harbin.
I mean, look, the political right does have an obsession with
cryptocurrency. They really do. They really do.
You know, Elon Musk, Trump, there is a real fixation with it. My concern is because it's an avenue of financialization that it's an even less regulated area of finance, which I think is, you know, is something that unites the sort of disparate elements of the right. You know, this desire to have totally unregulated financial spaces. Like, it feels like a sort of cryptocurrency is, as an area, a sort of like a kind of subprime mortgage on steroids. Like,
yeah.
That's why I think there is this kind of weird affiliation with it.
Yeah, no, it's anti-state trust on steroids, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I get that these libertarians want a small state, a vanishingly small state, a lack of regulation, but it is fascinating, isn't it, that they find the finance sector to not be regulated enough.
You know, Farage isn't and has never been an insurgent, and his economic platform has always been, you know, more aligned with someone like Kwasi Kwarteng than I think sometimes any of us really give enough time to. You know, this is a man who's essentially sort of re-employing a bunch of high-ranking conservative officials from the last catastrophic government and is now outside of politics pumping money into a Bitcoin that's being championed by the moron who
crafted the Liz Truss mini budget that tanked the economy. So, I mean, this, you know, Farage is and always has been an instrument of the establishment. Mm-hmm. And that, this is just further to that. Like, it, you know, when I read this news, it was kind of like, of course, that makes perfect sense with everything that he does. I think one of my least evolved political views is when someone says they're a libertarian, there's always a part of me that's like, oh, fucking just grow up. Fucking grow up. What, are you a fucking 12-year-old? We don't need the government. We can make our own hospital. Shut up.
If you are dating cisgendered men, and at any point that man says they have an interest in crypto, just leave, get out, pack a bag, go, okay? It's just for your own good. I'm here to help you. It's a red flag, a giant red flag. On that note, though, this is time to mention our mailbag episode.
Yeah, we're doing another mailbag episode. Well, if everyone wants to immediately contribute to the mailbag episode, why? By listing your favourite Coco Khan sounds. That would be great. The mailbag episodes are always great. We always get questions that we are unable to answer for time, because we always run out of time because the news is insane.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of political questions, but we do also welcome the jovial. So perhaps you would be interested in knowing how many Keep Cups the so-called environment-loving Nish Kumar owns.
Yeah. Also some predictions, like, for example, how long is Keir Starmer going to last? I mean, that prediction... That question could be irrelevant.
Yeah, true. Very true. So if you are going to send in a question, please do, and send them to psuk@reducelistening.co.uk or drop a note in the comments. They'll be answered in a special episode at the start of April.
And if you are a libertarian and you are listening, just seriously fucking grow up. Like, grow up.
I don't think the libertarians are listening to this podcast.
We can make
somehow.
Our own schools. Fucking grow up. You're pathetic. You're absolutely pathetic.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the UK. Don't forget to follow @PodSaveTheUK on Instagram, TikTok, X and Blue Sky.
Thanks to lead producer May Robson and digital producer Jacob Liebenberg.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Our engineer is Jeet Vasani and our social media producer is Nada Smiljanic.
The executive producers are Kate Fitzsimons and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.